Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
If I decide to run, you'll have the great pleasure of voting for the man that will easily go down as the greatest president in the history of the United States, me, Donald John Trump.
Yes, we all know what happened since then, and we all know about Donald John Trump's massive ego. But is the 45th president unfit to govern? Does he pose a danger to the country? A Baltimore-based psychologist and other mental health professionals have been trying to make the case that Trump has the personality of a fascist dictator and poses a risk to national security. Of course, the nearly 63 million Americans who voted for Trump in 2016 would disagree vehemently, and so would those who continue to cheer him on at the midpoint of his four-year term. This is Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun with episode 440 of the Roughly Speaking podcast. Some psychiatrists believe it's unethical to make clinical assessments of anyone they have not personally examined, citing a rule that has been in place since the 1970s. It's known as the Goldwater Rule, named for the Republican presidential candidate of 1964, whose mental state was the subject of speculation by psychiatrists of the day. They had been asked to give their opinions of Goldwater by a now-defunct magazine called Fact that led the American Psychiatric Association to establish a rule against diagnosing people from a distance. Many psychiatrists believe the rule should apply to their peers, yes, even in the age of Donald Trump. Psychologist John Gartner feels differently. He is a leader of a group of mental health professionals called Duty to Warn. Their campaign began as an internet petition seeking to have Trump's cabinet invoke the 25th Amendment, which lays out the procedure for removing a president who is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. The petition has garnered more than 70,000 signatures. There has been a book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which included the writings of 27 psychiatrists, psychologists, and other mental health experts who argue that, in Trump's case, their moral and civic duty to warn Americans supersedes professional neutrality. It has been more than a year since John Gartner and his colleagues, who believe they have this duty, went public with their assessments of Trump. The day after the midterm elections this week, I caught up with John Gartner at his office on the grounds of the Shepherd and Enoch Pratt Hospital in Towson, wondering what the last year has been like for his movement to warn American voters about their president.
One of the things that's been so shocking for everyone about the last 2 years is how, even though we've seen how shockingly dysfunctional, evil, norm-busting, you know, completely out front Trump is with all these things, how they quickly become normalized. So we did get an enormous amount of attention with our movement, probably climaxing with The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, which was on the New York Times bestseller list. And I think the reason that book was on the bestseller list, because I have to say, in my entire life, I've not once seen an edited academic book make the New York Times bestseller list. Can you think of a single example?
No, and I see a lot of books from university presses that professors publish, and no.
I mean, this is like the black swan or lightning striking. I mean, it is truly extraordinary. And I think the reason is very simple. I think there was a tremendous hunger in the population for understanding what the heck is wrong with this guy. He's obviously nuts, but no mental health professionals are explaining it to us because of this crazy Goldwater rule that basically became a gag order for the entire mental health profession. So it was sort of like see no evil, hear no evil. You know, we were basically not coming forward and speaking the truth that we knew to be the truth. You talk to any mental health professional and they will tell you that he is dangerous and disturbed and unfit, but somehow they felt super ego bound to follow this Goldwater rule. So they created this huge vacuum of people desperate for professional expertise to make sense of this madman, and yet no one was speaking up. So that's why I think the book was, I mean, it was a good book, but I don't think that's why it was a bestseller. I think it was a bestseller because it fit a need that was felt among three quarters of the population. That said, it didn't really change that much. And that's what's really sort of so tragic and frightening about all this, is every time it's revealed to us how really dangerously fascistic this guy is. And in this way, I guess I can say I was a little prescient, because I was saying really right after the inauguration, this guy is a fascist and he is going to rule as an authoritarian and he is not going to pivot and become more presidential. And the reason I said that is not because of some great deep insight on my own part. It's because I saw he met the criteria for malignant narcissism.
From Wikipedia, malignant narcissism is a syndrome comprising an extreme mix of narcissism, antisocial behavior, aggression, and sadism. Always ready to raise hostility levels, the malignant narcissist dehumanizes the people with whom he associates.
Malignant narcissism is a diagnosis that was introduced by Eric Fromm, a Jewish psychoanalyst who himself barely escaped Hitler. And it was his attempt to explain the psychology of dictators like Hitler and Stalin and Mussolini, who he had lived through, but also murderous dictators in general. And it has four components. Narcissism, which of course is obvious in him, right? Only he can fix it, and he knows more about everything than everyone, and he's entitled to everything.
They say, I have the most loyal people. Did you ever see that? Where I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters, okay? It's like incredible.
Paranoia. So this is where the conspiracy theories, the demonization of the press, of minorities who he scapegoats, of his opposition, the feeling that somehow he's an aggrieved victim, that's the paranoia.
Republicans believe in the rule of law, not the rule of the mob. That's what it is. It's a mob. I need your help this election day, November 6th, to stop the radical Democrat mob from trying to take it away.
You don't give power to an angry left-wing mob.
If you allow the wrong people to get into office, things could change. They could change, and they could change fast. You don't hand matches to an arsonist. And you don't give power to an angry left-wing mob, and that's what they've become.
Then you add the third component, psychopathy or antisocial personality disorder. So these are people who are criminals by character. So they lie, they violate laws, they violate norms, they exploit other people and feel no remorse about it. And then the fourth component, the one that gets the least attention but in some ways is the most important, sadism. People who truly get pleasure from harming other people, who have a kind of malignant malevolence, where it actually, they're like kind of like evil villains in like Batman, you know, who laugh hilariously as they're about to, you know, kill everyone in the city. I mean, that's the kind of evil we're talking about. Someone who actually would look at something like the zero tolerance policy and get joy from it, pleasure from it, enjoy the screams of those children who are being torn from their parents. So this is what defines a Hitler. Okay, these are the components that make up the psychology of this type of leader, and we've had them all throughout history. Hitler's just the worst example, but he's not the only example. And so one of the things Eric Fromm said is that these people do not get better. I actually studied with someone named Otto Kernberg, who's currently the most renowned living expert on malignant narcissism, and he used to say they're untreatable. If you have a patient who's a malignant narcissist, get rid of them immediately, because you will not help them, they will destroy you. That's how bad it is. The other thing Eric Fromm said, though, is they get dramatically worse once they get their hands on power. So instead of pivoting and becoming presidential, they become more grandiose. Look at me, I'm king of the world, you know, and so it inflames their grandiosity. Wait, look at those people who are trying to stop me from grasping complete power. They are evil, and they need to be destroyed, and I'm going to enjoy destroying them.
They want to do things. You know, I keep hearing about investigations. Been a long time. They got nothing. Zero. You know why? Because there is nothing. But they can play that game, but we can play it better. Because we have a thing called the United States Senate. And a lot of very questionable things were done between leaks of classified information and many other elements that should not have taken place. So we can look at us, they can look at us, and then we can look at them. And it'll go back and forth, and it'll probably be very good for me politically. I could see it being extremely good politically, because I think I'm better at that game than they are, actually.
Okay, that's the kind of psychology we're talking about. So when I was calling him the American Hitler, people got mad at me because, no, of course, you shouldn't make light of the Holocaust by comparing it to something lesser. And so, no, there's never been anything like the Holocaust. But what I'm trying to say is this is the same type of psychology. And so it's also the kind of person who has no moral code, who has no limits in terms of his behavior, who will do anything and harm anyone to any degree and in any quantity to get what he wants. And so that's what we're seeing. We're seeing the gradual sort of process of America becoming fascist. It is happening here, and we're not invulnerable. And if you listen to Plato, who was talking about democracy way back in ancient Greece, the natural arc of democracy is towards dictatorship, because eventually the mob takes over and they hire an autocrat, they hire a demagogue, and it's all over. And that has been what has happened to democracies over history.
We're sitting in your office here at Shepherd Pratt. Trump has never been in here, and I'm sure you've heard this as a criticism. John, how can you say these things about a person that you've never asked questions of, you've never had on the couch? That goes to the Goldwater rule. You know, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to make these long-distance drive-by assessments of people.
The Goldwater rule goes back to the election of Barry Goldwater, where some psychiatrists, actually a magazine called Fact Magazine, did a survey of psychiatrists about Goldwater's mental health. They published some of the verbatim quotes from some of the psychiatrists, and this was in the era of Freudian psychiatry. So some of the things they said were extremely speculative and probably wrong. That he was a latent homosexual, that he had unresolved Oedipal issues, that he'd been scarred by his potty training. I mean, these are actual things they actually said. And so I actually interviewed the last living member of the American Psychiatric Association Ethics Committee that drew up the Goldwater Rule. He's a professor down in GW. And I interviewed him, and he said, look, we never meant for the Goldwater Rule to be a gag order. But what happened with Goldwater was wrong. First of all, what they were saying was wildly speculative, and they couldn't have known that without interviewing him about his potty training or what have you. And so what we said was, you should not make these kind of wild, speculative public statements, because it hurts the profession. Since that time, and he agrees with me about this, the profession has changed our diagnostic system. In the 1980s, we switched to the DSM system. We're up to DSM-5 now.
The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, published by the American Psychiatric Association, and offers a common language and standard criteria for the classification of mental disorders. It's used by clinicians, researchers, the legal system, and policymakers.
And the DSM is based on a simple principle that all diagnoses should be based on observable behavior, that the criteria are now observable behavior. So I don't need to know the inner workings of your psyche. I don't need to know about your potty training, your relationship with your dad. I need to know whether you evidence these behaviors. For example, for antisocial, do you lie? Do you violate norms and laws? Do you show a lack of remorse for the things you do? Do you routinely exploit and violate the rights of others? Well, guess what? I can prove to you that Donald Trump meets those criteria. He's basically the Guinness Book of World Record holder in lying. This is a documented fact, according to the fact checkers at The Washington Post.
The Washington Post new report out today, 1,100 lies and mistruths in October alone, an average of 30 a day. That's a land speed record of lying, people.
Yeah.
There's no one you know in your life that lies that much. And yet this is from the bully pulpit of the presidency. That's disfiguring to our national debate.
Let me just read what the Washington Post says about that. In the first 9 months of the presidency, the president lied an average of 5 times per day. But in the 7 weeks leading up to the midterms, it's an average of 30 lies a day.
Okay, so check. I can check that box. Okay. Does he violate the rights of others? Well, I don't know. Is sexual assault violating someone's rights? Is charging people money for Trump University and scamming them violating someone's rights? Check. I can check that box. So with great objectivity, reliability, and validity, I can check those boxes. And in fact, it's not a drive-by diagnosis because I'm observing Donald Trump's behavior.
We all are. There's videos. I was going to say another comparison with Goldwater. Goldwater was 1964 presidential candidate. And I guess Americans saw him on TV now and then as they got closer to the election, but certainly not as much exposure as we've seen from Donald Trump.
No, exactly. In fact, I got to know John Dean during this process. We met on a radio show and we've become friends. And he was actually close to Barry Goldwater. And he said, look, Barry Goldwater was the father of one of my closest friends in prep school. He wasn't emotionally unstable. He was conservative. But it really was unfair. He was untrue. He was not unstable. But people didn't know the real Goldwater. They just knew the image of Goldwater. Here, you're correct. We are observing, all of us are observing his behavior every day. So I know more about Donald Trump's behavior than all of my patients put together, because I don't follow them around all day. I don't see what they say at work. I don't read their social media feed. I don't talk to their 15 closest associates and ask what they think about how they're doing. But if I read Vanity Fair or Washington Post, I can read interviews with people who are in the Trump administration, whether they're speaking anonymously in anonymous op-eds or whether they're speaking to, you know, people who are writing books like Bob Woodward. We have dozens and dozens of people that are saying, we talk about the 25th Amendment every day here. We've got a hashtag for it. And that in psychiatry.
Excuse me, but you could probably argue that it's been no more exposed president than Trump. Given the amount of exposure he gets, if you just watch his rallies that are televised on Fox and other cable channels.
Well, and in the era of Twitter, we have something like 50,000 tweets. I mean, that is a sample of behavior. And so we have right there in black and white that he lies, that he abuses people, that he has crazy paranoid conspiracy theories, that he demonizes minorities. These are all the criteria for malignant narcissism.
How do you convince people who like Trump and support Trump for whatever reason? I mean, it's hard for me to discern exactly, given all the information we have about him and the observations that we've made about his behavior, how people can continue to support him as president of the United States. But millions do. How do you convince them that what he's doing constitutes a diagnosis and not just a political strategy?
Honestly, I don't think we can. I think there's a group of people who are essentially lost to us. These are the people who watch Fox News, who drink the Kool-Aid, who are living in the right-wing noise machine, and who are completely convinced. They're like cult members. I think they're beyond our persuasion. That's why I've been saying all along, we don't need to convince them, we need to defeat them. I think that's what this election was about. It wasn't about winning over Trump voters. We didn't win over any Trump voters in this election.
And he didn't try to win over anybody from the other side either.
No,
he just played to his base.
And that's what we did. And we brought in more voters, who newly registered voters, young voters, low-frequency voters, minority voters, energy from suburban women. This is what propelled us to victory in the House of Representatives. And I think ultimately this is what's going to propel us to victory politically. But there's no convincing these people. We don't have to win them over. We have to defeat them.
What happened? Because I wonder about this all the time. I mean, Fox News has been around for, 22 years now, since the mid-1990s, I think. And I know people, that's all they watch is Fox News, or they listen to Rush Limbaugh, but they're in that echo chamber that you're talking about. What happened to the idea of the marketplace of ideas, getting your information from multiple sources, reading a daily newspaper, reading a magazine, even if you throw it across the room because you don't like what you read in it? That takes, intellectual discipline. That takes a willingness to consider others and to have an open mind. It seems like people just want to have their prejudices affirmed.
I think that's exactly right. You and I are old enough to remember when there were four television stations.
I was going to say, there were only, there were four. There were three when I started, CBS, NBC, and ABC. And then, public television. And then later on, UHF stations, whatever those were, the fuzzy channels. You're right. But originally, it was like the major networks, daily newspapers, weekly news magazines.
You had the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, the New York Times, you had Time, you had Newsweek. Right. And I think the law of unintended positive and negative consequences, we were more deprived in a sense, but we were all then reading the same facts. You could say the press was biased, but still they were fact-based. And so we were all listening to the same set of facts. And that gave us a common ground as a people. Now it's like there's a group of people who have left planet reality. The saucer has disconnected from the ship. And they are now orbiting in their own orbit, completely self-enclosed.
And they're comfortable there.
and they're comfortable there. And so, yeah, you can send people, you know, an article from the Washington Post or the New York Times, and they'll just say fake news. And this is extraordinarily destructive and dangerous, because now truth itself has been essentially surgically removed from a third of the population. There's a third of the population are basically impervious to truth, fact, and logic.
And, of course, the personality that you're describing in Trump needs this, loves this. This is his playing field.
Well, you know, Hitler had a great insight. He said, he called it the great lie. He goes, if you tell a lie often enough, people will start to believe it. And then they start to, the corollary is, then they start to get their truth from you, not from what they hear or they see or they read or what the facts are. And so a demagogue depends on that. A demagogue depends on controlling information. And so all demagogues have certain steps that they all follow in common. They all attack the press.
The mainstream media, these people back here, they're the worst. They are so dishonest, absolute scum. Remember that, scum. They're totally dishonest people.
They all attack the press. That's why journalists are killed in places like Russia. Okay, they have to attack the free press. So the fact that he calls the press the enemy of the people, no, he is the enemy of the people. The press are saving the people.
Roughly Speaking is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes Gregory Boyle to discuss his book about gang intervention, Barking to the Choir, The Power of Radical Kinship. In an era of mass incarceration, Father Boyle adopted the radical and effective approach of treating gang members as humans. Friday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop. More at theivybookshop.com or call 410-377-2966. Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
Another thing I wonder about, and I'd like you to comment on, I don't believe Donald Trump is that smart. And I don't believe he came into the presidential campaign with a strategy to do what he's done. I think he started pushing buttons and saw that he got a response. You push a button and there's a big noise, or there's an exciting light and shiny objects, and or people cheer or people laugh, and he kept doing it. But I don't think he went into it with this strategy to become an authoritarian or an autocrat. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, it is an interesting phenomenon that he really seems to be not that bright, and yet in another sense it seems like he's accomplished the impossible, right? So it is a great paradox. And I think your point is actually well taken, which is he realized that with these racist themes, he got a response. You know, it started with the birtherism, right? And, you know, I think he actually is a racist. He's always been a racist. His dad was a racist. You know what I mean? They didn't give apartments to black people in New York. I mean, this goes back a long way. But the idea that he could gain power by pulling these levers, you're right. It's like what you described is what we call shaping in psychology. You know, you press a bar, a rat presses a bar, and they get a pellet. They press the bar more and more and more because it works. The other thing is a lot of people don't realize, but Roger Stone was really the political mastermind behind his rise, more than Steve Bannon. It was Roger Stone that told him to hire Steve Bannon. And Roger Stone has always believed in racism and nationalism as an organizing principle for politics. He's been pursuing that dark art for a long time. So he also had this kind of mastermind behind the scenes that was actually directing him in that direction as well.
To what end? Help me understand, why do you want to come in and destroy a democracy? Why do you want to make it a autocracy in disguise as a democracy, or whatever we're headed toward if we don't do something? What's in it for these guys?
Well, he doesn't care about the country at all. He doesn't give a whit about America. It's all about what's good for him. So obviously, this is working out pretty well for him. The other thing I think to keep in mind is he is in complete collusion with Vladimir Putin. So at this point, we actually are, we're actually not the United States of America anymore. We're actually like Ukraine. We're like a puppet state of the Soviet Union at this point. We have a puppet leader who actually is beholden to Vladimir Putin. And it's really an international oligarchy here, which is actually taking over. Because what they have in common is this sense that they are all billionaires, they're all oligarchs, they're all authoritarians, they're all corrupt. And so what they do is by working together as a criminal gang, they're essentially taking over the world and dividing up territory. So, you know, Donald Trump's the capo in charge of the United States, but he works for the big man. Or you could take a Star Wars analogy. He's Darth Vader and Putin is the emperor. But basically, it's a gang.
And they just added a gang member in Brazil.
Exactly.
And they have Orban in Hungary.
Yeah, no, exactly right. That's exactly right. All these strongmen, all these authoritarians are kind of in it together. Basically, it's sort of like, you know, Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, right? Let's be the strongmen. We'll have a sit down. We'll divide up the map. We'll divide up the world. This is your territory. This is my territory. But of course, like gang members, they end up fighting each other anyway. But the point is that we'll have a temporary alliance where as gang bosses, you know, gang bosses slash oligarchs, we will control the world and divvy up the map.
But see, you know what? When you say that, John, that now you start to sound like one of those folks with their conspiracy theories over on the right.
Well, here's the difference. This is an actual conspiracy.
There's evidence, there's facts to support it. Yeah.
Right. There's a difference between a crazy conspiracy theory and an actual conspiracy.
You think this is something Mueller is probably looking at?
I think it's something Mueller knows about. I'm very worried about Mueller, of course, as we all are, because they already have a plan to get rid of Mueller. If they can get rid of Rosenstein or Sessions or both, they have a plan to shut down these investigations, not even just the Russia investigation, but the Cohen investigation. They have a plan to shut down these investigations. And by the way, people who study fascist societies will tell you, you know what defines a democracy? You're going to say elections probably, but it's actually not elections. It's the rule of law. That's what defines a democracy. It means no one's above the law. Okay, meaning that they can get away with anything, and no one's below the law, meaning minorities have rights that are protected. They are corrupting the rule of law. You know, piece by piece, they have literally been like taking out members of the Justice Department, right? Beginning with the FBI director, but now they have actually demoted or fired most of the senior people involved in the Russia investigation. These people, you know, McCabe and people you never even heard of who were like tertiary positions, but they were actively on point on the Russia investigation. They're purging them from the department. And then once they get someone who's not recused, who is his Roy Cohn, as he's asked for when his attorney general, they are going to entirely corrupt the justice system. And then, of course, there's Brett Kavanaugh, who, by the way, a lot of people don't realize really how dirty Brett Kavanaugh is. I studied Brett Kavanaugh's career very carefully because I wrote a biography of Bill Clinton, and Brett Kavanaugh was Ken Starr's point man in the whole impeachment process. And he was the chief person involved with illegally leaking information to the press. That was his main function. Just like he stole email, you know, used stolen emails to give a heads up information to Republican judges who were coming before Congress. This guy is an operative. He's not a journalist.
By the way, we never got to any of this in the Senate confirmation hearings.
Exactly, because they made it was a kangaroo court. They gave everyone 5 minutes to talk. They suppressed the information. But even if this guy weren't a sexual abuser, which of course he is, which is enough reason not to convict him. And even if he wasn't an entitled character disordered baby, which he displayed in his rage over being questioned in the second set of hearings, he is not a judge. He is not a lawyer. He is not a jurist at heart. He's a cold political operative, and that's who he is. And so I can predict that he will vote for the Republicans every single time, and then if a case comes before him with the exact same arguments, but there's a Democrat on the other side, he'll vote the other way. He doesn't care about precedent. He doesn't care about the appearance of wrongdoing. So this is the third branch of government, the one that's supposed to be the least political, and it has gone all the way into the gutter.
So what is your hope? What is the only hope here? What is the hope here? How do we get out of this?
Well, no, I share your fear and your confusion. I think we all do. I do feel, though, after tonight's election, even though there were some big disappointments, obviously, the fact that we won the House is really preventing an extinction event for American democracy.
If it hadn't happened.
If it
where would we be for the next 2 years?
We'd be in free fall. There would be tanks in the streets. I honestly believe that, rolling over protesters. There'd be no restraint, no restraints whatsoever. Now at least there's one check, one balance. And so I think what's going to happen is the House of Representatives is going to open up investigations that are just going to reveal shocking corruption, treason, obstruction of justice. But the core thing, treason. This is treason. They're working with Russia. I mean, the NRA funneled Russian money into Republican campaigns. This is not the Republican Party. This is the Russian Party. This is an unholy alliance between Russia and the Republicans. And it's a very formidable force. But as Winston Churchill said, this is not the end. This is not the beginning of the end. But it is the end of the beginning. The fact that we got the House of Representatives means we're on the board, we have a voice, we can expose these things, even if a third of the country won't believe it, even if the Senate will not convict him, even though we will prove that he is a treasonous president. I think it will be enough dirt to keep him from being reelected, and I think the wave that we saw in the House of Representatives will continue to build, and with a more favorable senatorial map, I think we'll start then to pick up Senate seats. So it's going to be a gradual process. It's going to continue into 2020 and then maybe into 2022, but that's the way back, I think.
John Gartner is a psychologist and therapist with an office in Towson. He specializes in the treatment of borderline personality disorder, bipolar disorder, and depression. He is the author of numerous articles and a couple of books, including a psychological biography of Bill Clinton. He is a leader in Duty to Warn, a group of mental health professionals who believe they have a duty to warn the public about the danger that Donald Trump's mental health poses to the world. More information about the group in the notes with this podcast. That's our show for now. Please review us if you get a chance at iTunes or on your podcast app. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. For producers Steve Early and Hallie Miller, thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking is brought to you by the first annual Festival of Jewish Literature, sponsored by J. Moore Magazine and the Ivy Bookshop. Over the course of 11 days, from November 8th to November 18th, a dozen events across Baltimore will feature fiction, comedy, politics, children's books, and great writers such as Deborah Tannen and Dara Horn. Most events are free and open to the public. For more information, go to festivalofjewishliterature.com or call the Ivy at 410-377-2966. More at theivybookshop.com.